This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The president of Taiwan, Chen Shui-bian, announced today that he would accept a recount of Saturday's presidential election, which he won by an extremely slim margin. The opposition party disputed the results, saying irregularities marred the election. Since Saturday, opposition party supporters have been camped out in front of the president's office calling for a recount. President Chen appeared on TV looking weak from a gunshot wound incurred in an assassination attempt on the eve of the election. Chen's challenger, Lien Chen, has suggested the shooting may have been staged to gain sympathy from the voters. The outcome of the vote remains crucial as it will determine the future of relations between Taiwan and China. President Chen has been pushing for an independent Taiwan, which China will not accept. China has threatened military force to stop it. What does all this mean for security in the region? Results of the Taiwan elections is the talk of this hour. What's at stake in Taiwan? Do you have questions about the politics in this region and how it could affect the U.S.? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Tim Culpin is a freelance reporter in Taipei. He joins us now from outside the presidential palace in Taipei, where protesters are still gathered, even though it's 3 a.m. there. Thanks, Tim, for being with us.
Good to join you.
Can you describe the scene there right now?
Well, I've got to be honest, the scene is somewhat festive. It kind of resembles a bit of an outdoor rock festival more than an angry protest. People are still here after 4 days. As you said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday morning here in Taipei. It's been raining a little bit throughout the evening, and that seems to have sent some people home. And the crowd is now at about 4,000. It had got up to about 15,000 over the last few days, but you know, people are tiring a little bit, but they're still here. They're still determined to make sure that their demands are met, and they're still here to press those demands.
Are they satisfied at all by the news that the president has agreed to a recount?
Well, they are satisfied to some extent. The thing is that the president had never denied the idea of a recount since the election result on Saturday night. You know, at 8 o'clock that night, the challenger, Lien Chen, had asked for a recount. But the process of actually having a recount is not so straightforward. You actually have to go through the courts, and you actually have to basically sue the candidate or the electoral commission and ask for a recount. And then the court would decide what the outcome should be. They can ask for a nullification of the vote, which would mean that a new election be held, or they can ask for a partial recount in certain, you know, ballot areas or in certain regions of Taiwan, or they can ask for a total recount. So the fact that the president has come out and said, yes, I accept the idea of a recount, is really only a partial victory for the opposition.
How long is a recount likely to take?
Well, this is part of the problem. If it was to go through the courts through the normal process, the actual courts would be the ones doing the recount, and that could take, you know, 3 to 6 months. If it took, say, 3 months and a recount was finalized and they did have a final challenger, then the opposition or the plaintiff in the court case could then ask for an appeal, and that would go to a higher court again, and the whole process could be done again. If it's done through an executive order, which is what the opposition is pushing for, this would basically be an emergency decree by the president asking for a recount. And this is an extraordinary situation. Under this kind of process, it could take, you know, 3 to 6 days. And, you know, that is basically what the opposition is pushing for. But the president has been wary of doing an actual emergency decree for two reasons. One is that he feels that it should be done through democratic means. There are laws and regulations set up to deal with problems in the ballot, and if someone wants to challenge it, there are laws and regulations, and that is to go through the court. And the president's argument is that these laws and regulations did already exist, and we should follow those, and he doesn't want to institute an emergency decree because he feels that that goes against the concept of democracy.
Well, the opposition party has charged that there were a number of irregularities in this election. What are some of those charges? What are the irregularities that they're saying existed?
Well, they did come out on Monday afternoon with quite a long shopping list of irregularities. The top one actually is what happened before the actual election, and that is the shooting. On that afternoon and evening after the shooting happened on Friday, the day before the election, they did kind of hint that they didn't believe that it was true. They've since come out and basically said, openly that they believe it was a hoax and a fraud, and they've gone through with various reasons why they think that's the case. In terms of the ballot itself and the election and the way that was conducted on Saturday, they've charged that among the problems are that votes that were counted as invalid should have gone to the opposition, and some of those that did actually go to Chen Shui-bian should have been counted as invalid. That's one of the charges. Another is that there's been some double counting of some of the ballots for Chen Shui-bian, that there was only one ballot for Chen, but it was marked as two or three, and in some cases undercounting for the opposition, where two or three ballots that should have gone to Lian Jian were actually counted together as just one ballot. So that's just some of the objections they have to the whole process.
Is there any real evidence at this point that this assassination attempt may have been staged? I mean, what is the basis for questioning that was really happened or was staged?
Well, if there is any evidence, it's certainly been short in coming from the opposition party. They've certainly come up with a lot of conspiracy theories. They've charged... basically, the main charges that they've come up with, and they did come up with a lot of them tonight, they actually wheeled out some former security staff who used to work under the other administrations. And these old-timers basically came out and said that, certain protocols for security of the president weren't followed, that the president and vice president should have been in the same jeep at the same time, that they should have been wearing flak jackets, that the jeep should have been driven by a professional security chauffeur, not by a local legislator, and so forth. And that kind of the implication there is that these protocols weren't followed. Why weren't they followed? Unless they knew that something was going to happen. And that is really the way they're implying that it could have been a hoax or a fraud and it all set up. But they haven't actually come forward with any evidence to show that it was a fraud. But by the same token, investigators have been very short on real evidence to show that it was truly, an assassination attempt. They did have a press conference today. Or Tuesday, Taipei time, just to present evidence. But they were questioned by the media, and they were very very scant in coming up with good answers to those questions that the media were putting to them.
Let's look ahead for a moment. Given that both parties accept the process that leads to a recount, are they likely to accept the results of a recount?
Well, this is something that the opposition has not been able to really answer. Now, Chen Shui-bian, in his televised address to the nation on Tuesday afternoon, did say, yes, I will accept the result, absolutely. So he's said, in no uncertain terms, that he'll accept the result of a recount. The opposition, on the other hand, have said, well, we're going to consult with our lawyers, and, we hold open the opposition of pushing for a nullification. If that happens, the whole electoral process will start again from scratch, and that could be very, very divisive for Taiwan.
All right, Tim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Tim Culpin is a freelance reporter in Taipei. He joined us from outside the presidential palace in Taipei. Taiwan expert Vincent Wong joins us now. He is associate professor of political science and coordinator of the Asian Studies Program at the University of Richmond, and he joins us from his office in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Lynn.
Before we go on to talk about the recent developments, which we were just discussing with Mr. Culpin, let's look back at history, at the history between Taiwan and China, and what makes these particular elections so crucial in terms of that history.
Yes, of course. When we talk about cross-strait relations, the United States is also an actor in this. 1949, the People's Republic of China was founded. The nationalist government, which the U.S. had recognized as the only China, moved to Taipei. So we essentially have Taiwan and mainland being ruled separately. The U.S. still recognized Taipei as the sole legal government of all China, which includes both Taiwan and the mainland. And in 1971, Taiwan left the United Nations. 1972, Nixon went to China and signed the Shanghai Communique, which says that the United States acknowledge that all Chinese on either side of the Taiwan Strait maintain there is only one China. Taiwan is a part of it. In 1979, the U.S. normalized relations with the PRC under the assumption that the U.S. acknowledge the Chinese position, but has taken no position on Chinese Taiwan sovereignty. Meantime, the Congress passed into the Taiwan Relations Act, which not only provides the U.S. Commitment toward Taiwan security, but also Article Number 4 talk about the U.S. Would treat Taiwan for all practical purposes as a country. In 1991, starting from 1991 with the last president, Lee Teng-hui, Taiwan gradually moved away from this one China tacit understanding or framework. In 1996, Taiwan's first presidential election, Lee Teng-hui, the incumbent, despite the Chinese missile threats, won by a majority. And the next election was 2000. The opposition Democratic Progressive Party, Chen Shui-bian, won in a three-way race. And the Chinese at that time sent paper missile, namely the White Paper, which threatened to use force against Taiwan if Taiwan does not come to a negotiation table for unification indefinitely. So every 4 years up to now, there seems to be some kind of a little crisis regarding mm-hmm. Taiwan's final status and its relationship with China.
And in this particular election, what would it mean if the existing election results stand, that is, if Chen Shui-bian wins this election?
Well, assuming Chen Shui-bian is eventually certified as the winner, I think he would very much consider his victory as a mandate for certifying the unmistakable Taiwan identity. I think that one thing he did last year, which worried a lot of capitals, including Beijing and Washington, was that he intends to write a new constitution and put it to a referendum in 2006 so that this new constitution, which essentially will reflect the political reality on Taiwan or the reality that there are two countries on either side of the Taiwan Strait, will probably unnerve Beijing and Washington a lot.
Now, there was a referendum included in this election, and it didn't pass.
Right. The wording for this referendum was whether the people of Taiwan should think that the government should increase anti-ballistic missile defense capability in light of Chinese missile threat, and whether the government should start a peace talk with mainland China. Both failed.
And so, what is the significance of the fact that they failed? What were then the voters saying?
I think this is one of the most interesting part. Apparently, the people outside Taiwan read more meanings into the passage or the failure of the referendum itself than the voters in Taiwan themselves. I spoke to a lot of people in Taiwan last week when I was there, and many of them thought that the referendum was unnecessary. And the opposition, namely the KMT and the PAP alliance, the Pan Blue, successfully engineered a boycott of the referendum. So the failure to pass this referendum sends a mixed message to all three parties involved, Taipei, Beijing, and Washington. For Beijing, they can claim partial victory that at least an immediate time bomb is now diffused, and so they can say that the referendum was unpopular and doomed to failure. And Washington, of course, prefer the referendum does not pass. And for Taipei, Chen Shui-bian get elected, but the voters tell him that this is only a partial mandate, not a total mandate.
We are talking about the dispute over the Taiwan elections and what it means for security in the region. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We are talking about the disputed Taiwanese elections and what it might mean for security in the region. Our guest is Taiwan expert Vincent Wong. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and the coordinator of the Asian Studies Program at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Have you ever been to the region? You're invited to join our discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to take a call now from Wiley, I believe it is, who's calling from Massachusetts. Hi, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'd just like to make a couple points. First, I'm originally from Taiwan, and I'd like to clarify what Vincent said about the Republic of China was formed in 1949. I think it was actually formed in 1911, back when Dr. Sun Yat-sen from China, that's how he started, but that's besides the point. I just want to make a point that I think Lan Chen and James Song are just really sore losers. This is sort of their last-ditch effort to really, you know, survive their political careers. The accusations that President Chen actually staged the assassination attempt is really ludicrous because this was not the first attempt on his life. In the early 80s, you know, his wife was ran over by the car, and that's why she's paralyzed ever since and been in a wheelchair.
It sounds like you've been following these elections very closely, although you are now here in the United States. These are important elections to you?
It is a very important election to me. My family's been in Taiwan for the last 500 years, so, you know, there's the divide between the mainland Chinese descendants and their, you know, parents probably came with Chiang Kai-shek when he fled to Taiwan in 1949, and there's the group of population who's been in Taiwan for a long time, where, you know, we identify ourselves more being Taiwanese than Chinese. I mean, I understand there's, you know, you can trace ancestry back to China where culturally we could be Chinese, but, you know, borders and, you know, identities are constantly shifting. I mean, 200 years ago, I'm sure a lot of Americans think they're from England.
So people who would trace their ancestry to Taiwan for a long time would tend then to be supporters of the president, the Chen Shui-bian?
Yes, in general, but I think there's also another factor in play where there's a lot of Taiwanese businessmen making huge investments in China. So when cultural identity clash with economic interest, you know, and I think loyalty is up for sale sometimes.
All right. Thanks for your call. I'd like to hear
our
guest respond to some of the comments that you made. Professor Wong.
Yes. I think the point about the emerging Taiwanese identity has been captured very well in opinion polls when we track the polls in the last 10 years. As I said earlier, more and more people of Taiwan identify themselves as Taiwanese. Granted, one can have multiple identities, but the polls tell us barely a decade ago about 40% of the Taiwan voters call themselves Chinese, and then about 37% call themselves both, and then the rest call themselves Taiwanese. 10 years later, these ratios were reversed. Today, over one half of Taiwanese voters call themselves Taiwanese, and fewer than 10% of them call themselves Chinese. So then the rest, of course, is double identity. So the trend is very clear, and one can argue that Chen Shui-bian capitalized on this Taiwan consciousness.
I'm wondering if Chen Shui-bian does, in the end, win this election, given that obviously the electorate is so divided. Would he really feel that he had a mandate to move ahead with some of the plans that he's had?
Yes and no. On the one hand, this time he received 50.1%, which is more than 39% he got last time. So he has improved, and also shows that more and more people in Taiwan can accept that a very distinct Taiwan identity and probably a separate country. In other words, the messages Chen and his party represent. On the other hand, as you said, 50.1%, that means almost one half of the electorate oppose him. If he is going to push forward very controversial and highly symbolic issues that have profound international implications, I think it's going to be very, very difficult.
And to what degree are the people of Taiwan ready truly challenge China to take them at their word on their threats?
I think from our polls, we find that interesting phenomenon, namely Taiwanese attitudes toward the mainland, are conditional in that this can be reflected by the fact that an overwhelming majority, over 80%, preferred the status quo. Well, the status quo is something everybody is talking about, but the meaning actually is different for everybody. Our finding is that if China would become democratic and the gap between the mainland and Taiwan become narrower, then we see an increasing number of people in Taiwan willing to be a part of China, to unify with the mainland. If, however, the mainland will not use force against Taiwan's declaration of independence, an increasing number of Taiwanese people also would favor declaration of independence at the present time. So the identity is really conditional. In other words, if they can achieve independence at low cost, they would do it. If they can achieve unification at low cost, they will also do it.
Professor Wong, can you stay on for a little bit longer?
Sure.
All right, because I would like to bring another guest in on this discussion so that we can talk about what all this means for the U.S. and for security in the region. Joining us now is Michael Swain. He is Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in U.S., China, and Taiwan security issues, and he joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Maybe we could now talk about what's at stake in the U.S., first of all, in these Taiwanese elections. And first of all, how is the administration reacting to what's going on at the moment?
Well, the administration's reaction so far has been to essentially congratulate the fact that a democratic election has taken place in Taiwan and to make statements that are very supportive of that entire process of development of democracy there. But thus far, the administration has avoided congratulating Chen Shui-bian as the victor because it is presumably waiting for the formal designation by the election commission in Taiwan and wants to make sure that there is no judicial procedure here that would stand in the way of him being validated as president. So since there is a challenge to his election, so Washington is taking a very hands-off position in terms of making a comment about the loser or the victor.
And how does the administration view Chen Shui-bian? Didn't President Bush actually admonish him during a visit to the White House?
Well, yes, he did, in effect. When the Premier of China was here in early December, he made a statement that he was concerned that the president of Taiwan was taking actions that would unilaterally alter the status quo on Taiwan, and that the United States is opposed to such actions. So this was a somewhat unprecedented statement by the President of the United States to make such a direct statement about the behavior of Chen Shui-bian, particularly in the company of the Premier of China. I think the Bush administration has been very, very concerned about the direction that Chen Shui-bian has been moving in cross-strait relations. He has apparently committed himself to holding national plebiscites in Taiwan on cross-strait issues, many of which, in the view of the administration and others, don't require referenda to resolve, that they're sort of no-brainer issues for the Taiwan public, but they have a high resonance in terms of emotional value across the strait, and that from the Bush administration's point of view, that just simply roils the waters in the cross-strait situation. And also, there's concern that these referenda could play into a long-term strategy by Chen Shui-bian to not just revise the existing constitution of Taiwan, but to replace it entirely with a new constitution, using the people of Taiwan, in effect, as the basis for that, and thereby change the existing basis of sovereignty of the Taiwan state and make it much more sort of a formally independent nation in terms of the process of the government on Taiwan, and that this would indeed escalate the situation much more significantly with Beijing, and that, in fact, this represents a very significant unilateral change in the status quo.
And, of course, the U.S. is concerned because it has an obligation to protect Taiwan in the event of aggression on the part of China.
Well, precisely. I mean, it has an obligation. The United States is committed to a peaceful resolution of the problem, and it expects that Beijing will continue to pursue a peaceful resolution as its primary objective. And at the same time, the United States is obligated by U.S. law under the Taiwan Relations Act to provide the necessary means for Taiwan to create its own capability for self-defense against any possible attack from the mainland, and for the U.S. government to be concerned about the defense of Taiwan. It doesn't explicitly commit the U.S. government to defending Taiwan, although the president has come very close to that sort of a commitment. But it certainly does indicate that the U.S. would be very concerned and likely very involved.
We are talking about the disputed Taiwanese elections. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Warren in Philadelphia. Hi, Warren.
Yes, this is Warren.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple of points I'd like to make. The so-called Taiwanese identity of the Taiwanese people has been actually promoted over the last 10 years since the former President Lee's reign since 1993 by deliberate government cultural policy and also educational policies. All the textbook has been changed gradually to, they have programmed so-called de-Chinesization. In other words, in every possible way, the government intentionally trying to separate Taiwanese from the Chinese by governmental policy. That has been done for a long, long time. That's why the national identity of Taiwanese become a so-called Taiwan nationalism rather than a allow people to fall back to their own heritage from the past. That's point one I'd like to make. Point two I'd like to make is the failure of the referendum to pass clearly indicated one thing, that Chen's victory is by either by luck of the so-called assassination attempt or by electioneering. Why? Because all Chen's supporters support the referendum, which only garnered 45% of the total vote. The last second, the day, the assassination attempt was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the day before election. And after that, all the gatherings, all the activities stopped on both sides. And the media was monopolized by the incumbent party. And all the radio stations owned by the Progressive Party, also the underground radio station in the southern part of the island, spread a rumor that Chinese communists trying to assassinate our president. We should fight the Chinese in the ballot box tomorrow.
If I could ask you,
what I'd like to make.
Okay, if I could ask you to listen, I'm going to ask. I'm going to turn to Professor Wong because thank you so much for calling, Warren. Professor Wong, I know you were in Taiwan recently. Perhaps you could fill in or explain to us some of the points that this caller was making.
I think the rise of Taiwanese identity has multiple sources. To say that it is all the work of a particular politician or political party is too simplistic. As the first caller mentioned, her ancestors came to Taiwan from mainland China, usually from the Fujian province, several hundred years ago. And these people, their descendants, when Chiang Kai-shek, KMT, the Kuomintang, was the ruling party of Taiwan, the Chiang Kai-shek dreamed of Taiwan as a temporary base from which he would recover China. He and Mao Zedong both believed in one China. The only difference is he believed that his China was the real China. Okay, so he advocated a policy of sinification. Mandarin was promoted at schools. The speaking of the Minnan or the Fujianese language, which is the language spoken by the native, was fined at school. And we as children knew a lot more about the geography on the mainland, where we have never been to, than what's close by in, say, from Taipei to Taichung. Mm-hmm. So over time, people in Taiwan gradually realize that their home is what they care more about. Over the years, the KMT also became more and more localized or nativized, bringing a lot of local elites, such as the previous president Lee Teng-hui. So I think that the trend of Taiwanization is a natural trend, not just a result of government promotion.
Professor Vincent Wong is an associate professor of political science, and he's also the coordinator of the Asian Studies Program at the University of Richmond. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We are discussing the Taiwanese elections on Talk of the Nation today. The number is 1-800-989-8255. And I want to return once more to the U.S. Involvement in this. Michael Swain, we have seen over the years tensions between Taiwan and China crop up periodically. Where would you place where we're at right now with these elections in terms of the level of potential tension and the problems that it might create for the U.S.?
Well, I would say that the level of tension at the moment right now is not terribly high. I mean, the election itself and even the referenda that failed in the election, even if they had succeeded, would not, in my view, have precipitated an immediate crisis in the Taiwan situation. But you have to look at the longer term a trend and how the election might feed into that. And what you've seen happen is that over the last decade or so, the Chinese have become increasingly concerned that the political evolution on Taiwan, what Vincent's just been talking about, democratization on Taiwan, which has led to a high level of Taiwanization of Taiwan, of the government there, has increased the likelihood that Taiwan will become eventually permanently separate from the mainland with the support of the international community, and that fear has led the Chinese government to become, and that the U.S. would support this process, and that fear has led the Chinese government to become more pessimistic and indeed at times threaten the use of military coercion to try and alter this kind of trend. Now, the fatalism or the pessimism of the Chinese government abated somewhat in recent years, actually, in large part for two reasons. One, because despite the election of Chen Shui-bian in the year 2000, he found it very difficult to rule in Taiwan. The government was very much divided. He does not control the legislature in Taiwan. There was essentially a deadlock in the government. And there was a significant number of individuals in the opposition who were very much opposed to moving Taiwan further away from the mainland or raising the likelihood of tension. And so you had a deadlock there that Beijing thought was
if you could summarize quickly, because we are going to run out of time.
Okay, was useful. And the other side was that you had an economic dynamic at work in which the mainland, in its continued economic growth, was drawing Taiwan increasingly into closer and closer relations. So there was greater optimism. But more recently, however...
We're going to have to end right there. I'm very sorry.
Oh, okay.
Michael Swain is Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We were also joined by Professor Vincent Wong of the University of Richmond. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.